Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. In just a few months, many lower and middle income families could start paying a lot more for insurance. That's because federal health care subsidies are set to expire at the end of this year. The Republican-controlled Congress says it doesn't plan to extend them. It's become a focal point in the current government shutdown fight, with Democrats insisting the subsidies be extended before they'll vote for a funding extension. Amy Feiereisel from the New York Public News Network reports on what the loss of subsidies would mean for New Yorkers.
Many people have never heard of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, even if they use them. They were originally created as part of Obamacare in 2012. They helped people pay for insurance who made too much to qualify for Medicaid, but made less than four times the federal poverty level. That means individuals making up to $60,000 each year. Health insurance for that person can cost around $12,000 a year.
$12,000 out of $60,000 is impossible, especially in a country in which 40% of the people do not have $500 to meet an emergency car or medical expense.
That's Chris Hoy, a recently retired physician who's lived and worked in northern New York for over three decades. His last job was with the Hudson Headwaters Health Network Clinic in Queensbury.
The tax credits became the way of allowing people to afford health care.
Especially small business owners, their employees, and people who work multiple jobs. Then the subsidies really ramped up when they were expanded in 2021 under the American Rescue Plan. That got another 12 million Americans on health insurance. And Hoy says it helped get New York's uninsured rate down to a staggeringly low 5%.
Finally arriving at something that essentially is universal health care for people in New York State.
But here's the thing. Most people don't know they're getting an Affordable Care Act subsidy. And that's because they're not labeled as such, says Hoy. When you search for insurance through the New York marketplace, you put in information like where you live and your income, and it gives you choices, none of which have a big red sign saying Medicaid.
The vast majority of people do not know that the marketplace is Medicaid. They don't know that the essential plan is Medicaid.
But that's exactly what Republicans see as the problem, that Medicaid has gotten too big. They say it needs to revert back to its original mission of providing insurance for only the very poor and the disabled. Cutting Medicaid back, including the expanded subsidies, was a central part of President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Democrats, like New York Senator Chuck Schumer, say the Affordable Care Act subsidies play a crucial role in the U.S. healthcare system. Without them, he says care will be inaccessible to many lower and middle income families.
And if you don't extend the Obamacare tax credits, people's premiums are going to go up $400-$500 a month, and they're going to start learning about that when they get the notices in October.
The New York State Department of Health says the subsidies support almost 2 million New Yorkers through marketplace plans and the state essential plan. If they expire, it estimates that average premiums statewide will rise by nearly 40%. That looks like a couple paying about $250 more per month for their insurance,
which is $3,000 annually. That's a big chunk.
Duncan Ryan Mann is an economics professor at SUNY Empire. He's been studying and teaching healthcare policy for over 40 years. He says the impacts of those raised premiums will be people giving up their insurance.
People have to pay a higher price for health insurance, and that's going to discourage people from buying it.
Especially younger, healthier people willing to risk it. Ryan Mann says that leads to something called adverse selection.
People that are less likely to need the insurance coverage will tend to opt out versus those people that need the insurance coverage will keep it. So on average, medical, the cost to those insurers is going to go up.
Insurers then pass that cost on in the form of even higher monthly payments for everyone else. Chris Hoy, the former Queensbury physician, is now a member of the Healthcare Coalition for the North Country. That group formed this spring with a mission of preserving Medicaid in the region, where a third of the population depends on it. Hoy says as people lose their subsidies, and some then drop their insurance, that will stress local hospitals because uninsured people don't seek primary or preventative health care.
By the time it gets bad enough, they end up going and have a much more advanced state of disease. and suddenly end up in an emergency situation and go to the emergency room. They have no insurance. The hospital is left with a great deal of uncompensated care.
Hoy says one of the coalition's greatest concerns is that Medicaid reductions, including the elimination of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, will squeeze out New York's smaller and rural hospitals, which are highly dependent on Medicaid.
And they're likely going to close or going to cut services or become urgent care centers.
The issue of whether the subsidies will be extended is now at the heart of the current government shutdown. And in less than a month, open enrollment starts for those insurance plans. If the subsidies do expire, many lower and middle income people will be in for some hefty sticker shock soon. Amy Feiereisel for the New York Public News Network.
Earlier this year, the village of Hoosick Falls turned on the tap for a new water supply following decades of contamination caused by local manufacturers. But a neighboring town is asking why they don't have clean water yet. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons reports.
We are absolutely ecstatic for Hoosick Falls. The question that's always been asked in Petersburg is, what about our water supply?
Ira Scher and his wife Kathy live in Petersburg. It's about a mile away from the Taconic Plastics manufacturing facility and the company responsible for the contamination of the town of nearly 1,400 people. Petersburg is 12 miles from Hoosick Falls. PFAS chemicals, including PFOA, were discovered in the town's water system in 2016, shortly after the discovery of similar chemicals in Hoosick Falls. PFAS chemicals, including PFOA, are used in a number of applications. The compounds have not been used at Taconic since the early 2000s, but the chemicals, which can cause ill health effects including cancer, are persistent in the environment. The town's soil, surface water, and groundwater around the Taconic's plastic facility is impacted. PFOA levels in the groundwater exceed the state's drinking water standards of 10 parts per trillion, ranging upwards of 1,000 parts per trillion before treatment. Scher, whose water is non-detect, says Petersburg hasn't seen the successful cleanup that other communities nearby and across the nation have received.
Petersburg has kind of always been the little town 12 miles away from Hoosick Falls. When this story broke in Hoosick Falls, they set up a command center down there. They pulled resources from all over New York State. They had, it looked like they were staging a war down there. It was unbelievable. And then there's little old Petersburg, and we've kind of felt that we're kind of that little quiet town that gets mentioned once in a while, but we have the same issues, just on a smaller scale as far as our population.
In 2021, Taconic agreed to pay a more than $23 million settlement to the town. The town also sued several other chemical manufacturers, including 3M and DuPont Co. in 2022. The DEC says it has executed a consent order with Taconic that requires the polluter to perform the remedial investigation and undertake various remedial actions that the DEC determines necessary under state oversight. PFAS tests are run on a monthly basis, according to the town's website. Granular activated carbon and point-of-entry filtration systems are used throughout the town by both the town and on private residences. Ian Bielby is the section chief of the DEC's Division of Environmental Remediation. Bielby says such an investigation can take several more years. Bielby says the DEC and Department of Health are continuing to evaluate exposure pathways and take action to prevent further exposure. He says following the remedial investigation, a feasibility study will occur.
We're currently working in the remedial investigation phase. The remedial investigation is a very broad term that covers lots of potential actions for both investigation and implementation of interim measures to, you know, physically go out and clean things up or put systems on water supplies and make sure that people's water is clean.
Part of the remedial study includes the study of fish and agricultural products. An upcoming geophysical study and new bedrock monitoring wells are being used in the investigation. The Petersburg Berlin landfill is also being investigated as a potential state Superfund site. Further, fish in Thayer's Pond, located in the village of Hoosick Falls, show elevated levels of PFOS. The health department recommends anglers practice catch and release only from Thayer's Pond until further notice. PFAS contamination has been found in several New York communities, including Postenkill, Newburgh, and Bennington, Vermont. Rob Hayes is the director of clean water at Environmental Advocates NY. In an interview with WAMC about changing federal regulations for water, he said while the community of Petersburg has rallied together over the last decade, there's more advocacy to be done.
So that agencies like the State Department of Health and the Department of Environmental Conservation continue to move aggressively to hold polluters accountable and continue cleanup efforts that are still underway.
In an email, Taconic says it does not comment to press regarding its remediation work. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage. We talked about their campaign in New York to pass legislation that would fairly compensate tipped workers.
This bill is to get restaurant workers to a full minimum wage with tips on top. New York State, we were very disappointed in 2019, when we had been fighting to end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, and Governor Cuomo, in response to pressure from the National Restaurant Association, basically said, okay, yes, you're right, we should give a full minimum wage, let tips be on top of the wage as they were always intended to be, but only for nail salon and car wash workers, not for restaurant workers. So we are trying to establish a full fair wage for all tipped workers. That's the bill that you just mentioned. And now there's a coalition to move additional legislation that would raise the minimum wage overall for all workers closer to the cost of living. So we are doing both. We are raising the minimum wage closer to the cost of living and working to end all sub-minimum wages. First and foremost, as Assemblymember Jessica Gonzalez Rojas and Senator Jackson are leading with us, that first bill is to end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. And then additional legislation to deliver on this affordability promise that Zoran has been running on. We do need to raise the minimum wage closer to the cost of living.
Truth question. Do you think that Senator Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the leader of the Senate, or Carl Hastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, are supportive of these moves? Where are their sentiments at this point, or do you really know?
I mean, we know that they have been supportive over the last several years. Senator Andrew Stewart Cousins has been a champion of these issues in the past, as has Speaker Hastie. Speaker Hastie, just as you know, just endorsed Zoran and was asked about his platform and said he fully embraces all elements of his platform. And we assume that includes raising the minimum wage closer to the cost of living. Even Governor Hochul has said recently that she understands that the minimum wage does have to go up, that it is far behind where it needs to be. Look, I do think folks are beginning to realize that this is an imperative. This is an imperative. These are, you know, even Carl Hastie said recently, these are incredibly popular issues. They poll incredibly well. They determine elections. But putting that aside, I mean, they are determining also the fate of New Yorkers, whether they can live in the state of New York. And frankly, I have to tell you, whether they can live. Look, during the pandemic, we had the most horrible situation happen with our members, which was that New York State did not recognize tip income towards the calculation of unemployment insurance benefits. So 2/3 of tipped workers in New York State who get that sub-minimum wage, not through any fault of their own, but because that is what New York State has agreed with the Restaurant Association to provide them, a sub-minimum wage where they have to rely on tips to feed their families. Well, New York State didn't recognize tips in the calculation of unemployment insurance. And so 2/3 of these workers were told, you don't earn enough to earn unemployment insurance like all the other workers in New York State. And so we heard from tens of thousands of workers who were denied the state unemployment insurance and felt that they had to go back to work before it was safe. And let me tell you, 12,000 restaurant workers died during the COVID pandemic because they were forced to go back to work because they couldn't get unemployment insurance and they had to go back to work when it was still unsafe. And frankly, as many restaurant workers died as healthcare workers, you know, and the healthcare worker situation was a tragedy, but they did fight for and win hazard pay. Our folks were not, forget hazard pay, they weren't even getting the minimum wage. And so people died. And so people have to understand at this point, especially with food stamps and Medicaid being taken away, right now this is a situation of life or death. The ability to live in New York or not, in an, or move to a different place, or frankly, the ability to live and feed your family. I do believe with food stamps being taken away at the federal level, we are going to see a hunger crisis, the likes of which we are not prepared for in New York State. And one of the best ways Speaker Hastie and Senate Majority Leader Cousins and Governor Hochul can respond to a massive looming hunger crisis is by raising the wages of these workers so they can afford to feed their families.
Yes, Aru Jayaraman, you almost took my question away, which is amidst all this, you have a federal government that's chopping left and right. And in all areas, that can't be good for people who aren't making a living wage.
No. And again, if Democrats want to show that they will deliver for people in a way that, you know, an autocrat will not or is not, they have to actually deliver.
That's Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New data from the National Park Service shows a growing impact on local economies as park tourism continues to increase since the pandemic. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine breaks down the numbers.
In 2024, national parks across the country were visited by more than 330 million individuals who spent an estimated $29 billion in local gateway economies. According to NPS, that spending helped support 340,000 jobs, generated $18.8 billion in labor income, as well as $56.3 billion in economic output into the national economy. In New York, which has 24 NPS-managed sites, the economic impact generated by park visitors was roughly $877 million, with more than half of that being spent on lodging and restaurants. Paul Steely White is Parks and Trails New York's executive director.
All those visitors, all that spending now means that our state park system is as economically impactful as our state's agricultural sector. So that really came as shockingly good news to all of us, just to know that our state park system is now in the big leagues, in a sense, right? With, you know, dairy and apples, and, you know, New York's ag sector is legendary throughout the country, and to know that our 250 state parks and historic sites are now on that same level was just really shocking and welcome news.
In 2021, New York's agricultural sector generated $3.3 billion, according to the United States Bureau of Economic Analysis. A study by the Political Economic Research Institute found that $1 million invested into parks resulted in a return of $10 million in sales, $4 million in labor income, and $7 million in state GDP.
So these are maintenance, you know, capital investments, capital improvements, all the money that goes towards making these parks and historic sites welcoming and comfortable for folks, you know, everything from parking lots to restrooms to trails, right? And so those dollars, you know, a 10-to-1 return on investment. So really just showing that the, you know, the tax money that's going into the system, I mean, people could argue that the system is priceless, right, just given all the mental health and physical health and quality of life benefits.
At Saratoga National Historical Park, a $6 million project funded by the Great American Outdoors Act was completed last spring. It upgraded exhibits, signage, and trailheads along the park's 10-mile-long Battlefield Tour Road. It comes as the region prepares for the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. Program Manager for Interpretation and Visitor Experience at Saratoga National Historical Park, Garrett Clower, says while the park exists to preserve the area's history,
those stories draw people, and people, of course, when they come here, they bring money. So yeah, we're really excited to be able to contribute to the local economy, and we're happy that our visitors are able to bring so many benefits to the area, as they're coming here to learn and recreate and everything. They're spending, often spending the weekend or spending the night, and they're buying food and gas and groceries and all that type of stuff.
According to the NPS data, more than 116,000 visitors to Saratoga National Historical Park spent $8.2 million in surrounding communities. Todd Shimkus is the president of the Saratoga County Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, when you think of our motto, health, history, horses, right? I think we've understood for a long time that history plays a significant role in boosting our local economy, and certainly the national park being here. Especially the county deserves a ton of credit. They are the 250th anniversary celebration, the committee that's working on that. They recognize that this is an opportunity for us to really market this park and our history to the world, to hopefully attract even more people, because the folks that travel for history also tend to spend money.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello-Levine.
Healthier meatballs may soon be on the menu, and you can thank New York State apple trees for that. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Cornell researchers have come up with a recipe for meatballs that includes up to 20% apple scraps, also known as pomace, without affecting taste. Ilad Tako, associate professor of food science in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Cornell University, and Tako Lab first-year PhD student Peter Gracie, focused on incorporating apple pomace into beef meatballs to reduce meat consumption and improve nutritional value. Gracie says New York State produces 600,000 metric tons of apples annually, and 25% of the fruit is left over after being processed for products like juice and cider.
I went to a local cidery here in upstate New York, and they showed us the process of how they press the apples and get as much of the juice out of the fruit as possible. One of the challenges we found was that it was difficult for the pomace to be food grade. So we decided to use the Agritech campus up in Geneva, New York, to create our own apple pomace. And then we freeze dried that pomace, ground it down to a fine powder to have it as an ingredient, food grade, and be able to go directly into the meatballs.
Gracie read studies of other researchers' experiments involving use of grape pomace in meat products and thought perhaps apple pomace could serve as a healthy, eco-friendly meat additive.
Red meat has no fiber to speak of, but we have this ingredient that has up to 40% dietary fiber in it. There has been research that's shown that the Western diet has a distinct lack of fiber in it. So if we can merge a product that is well known, a medium like beef meatballs, with a high fiber product like apple pomace, not only does it support a waste upcycle stream, but it also can have those fiber health benefits.
From a climate perspective, researchers agree keeping pomace out of landfills curbs methane emissions and reduces the environmental footprint of juice and cider production. But how does it taste? More than 100 people were recruited to sample two versions of 80% lean ground beef meatballs, one containing 10% pomace, the other 20%. Even with a small amount of internal color change to the meatballs, no one noticed any difference. Taco says pomace offers many enhancements to meatballs.
Pomace is very rich in different bioactives that are associated with multiple health benefits, like different polyphenols, for example, that are often referred to as antioxidants. The other thing is that it also slows down degradation of the product. So for example, in many meat products, we add different stabilizers that's supposed to extend their shelf life. In this case, we're using something that is natural that basically slows down this process.
With the price of beef soaring, Taco says apples in your meatballs could lower your grocery bill.
Prices are already expensive and it's not going to slow down. So absolutely, by using an upcycled material that currently is it's mostly waste. Some of the pomaces may be used for animal feed, may be used for, you know, like compost. Absolutely. If you're going to replace 20% of the meat with pomace and you're still going to like it, so not only you're gaining the additional nutritional benefits, but also, and potentially, this product is going to be cheaper.
How long before the pomaced meatballs appear on your table? Gracie and Taco say the challenge right now is to create the supply chain. Although New York processes tons of apple waste, the pomace currently available is not food grade, so tweaks would have to be made at processing facilities to make pomace ready to use in a human food product. But for now, Cornell researchers have planted the seed.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2540 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.